I'm Matthew Aaron Goodman, author of Hold Love Strong, a debut novel first published in April 2009 by Simon & Schuster and coming out in paperback in March 2010. The novel tells the story of Abraham Singleton, a young man born and raised in the Ever Park Projects. Born to a 13-year-old girl in his grandmother's apartment, Abraham's life and the lives of his family and friends are laden with the obstacles inherent in an impoverished urban community. But Hold Love Strong is not a tragic novel about growing up in urban poverty. Rather, what we find in the novel is a universal story of familial love and support, and how those forces help Abraham overcome devastating circumstances and self-doubt. The portion of the novel that I'll read from is the opening scene, the day Abraham is born. The first pain came at noon, but she didn't tell anybody about it. My mother was 13, and she went about the afternoon being every part of such a precarious age. She watched TV, she popped pimples and studied her face in the bathroom mirror. She listened to the radio, sang along with songs, and laughed along with the afternoon DJs. She wrote in her diary, "I still can't believe I'm pregnant." She scribbled in bulbous letters that began and ended in curls. "I can't believe my belly's so big." At 5, she took a nap and awoke 3 hours later, home alone and in a wet bed. She thought it was pee, balled the sheets, put them in the trash, and told herself she was disgusting. Then it was midnight, and the pain became a fiery Cinderella banging to flee her guts. Still, she ignored it. 20 minutes later, another pain came like the previous one, but angrier, and so along with the banging, it tore at her, buckled her knees, and left her coiled and crying on the floor. She had to do something. She had to find an answer, or something to distract her from the increasing frequency of such mercilessness, or some kind of pliers to rip and wrench the pain out of her. She went to her best friend Sherry's apartment, one floor below ours. It was a Friday night, and she knew Sherry would be awake watching TV. "It's just gas," Sherry decided, pouring my mother a glass of ginger ale in the kitchen. "What'd you eat?" "Some ring-dings and a bag of Doritos," said my mother. "A whole bag, damn," Sherry forced her surprise to fit into a whisper, because her mother was asleep in one room. Her big sister Candy was asleep in the other, and the walls in the apartment, like the walls in every Ever Park Project apartment, amplified even the slightest sound. Although Sherry had a way of convincing my mother that what was major was minor, and although my mother hoped that what was going on inside her was something trivial and unholy, she was still just 13. So she was scared, maybe even desperate. "Should I call James?" she asked. The year was 1982. There were no cell phones or pagers, so there was no way to get in touch with people unless you knew where they were or left a message where they would soon arrive. My grandmother and my mother's sister, my Aunt Rhonda, would have been my mother's first and second choices, but they had taken my Uncle Roosevelt and my cousins Donnell and Eric to see E.T., so there was no way of speaking to them, and calling where they would arrive meant calling where she had just left. As for James, he was my father. That is, James Llewellyn Arthur, so deceived that became me. He was 20. The last time my mother and he spoke, they fought over a retractable Bic pen. He wanted it. She wouldn't give it to him. He punched her breast. She stabbed him in the leg with it. That was the previous week. Since then, he was gone and never found. Never found a phone, never found another pen and paper to write a letter, never found two twigs to rub together to make a small fire so a smoke signal would drift into the sky and prove he knew we were alive. "James," said Sherry, wiping her mouth after swigging straight from the 2-liter bottle of ginger ale, "what's he gonna do?" Although the answer could only be nothing, my mother used Sherry's phone to call James. Of course, there was no James to speak to. "He was out," said his grandmother, an old woman with a wobbly, frayed voice who was too lonely to even wonder, let alone ask, why my mother was calling so late. "You know," she said, "come to think about it, I ain't seen James since yesterday. I hope he comes home tonight." "Tell him Angela called," blurted my mother. "Who?" "Angela." "Okay, Angela. That's such a pretty name. I once had a dear friend named Anita. That's a pretty name, too. Tell him I need to see him, that it's real, real important. Tell him to call as soon as he comes in. It don't matter what time it is." He has your phone number? Yeah, my mother answered, trying to sound confident, yet wondering if he remembered it. Because my mother hadn't left a note nor trace of where she went and why she left, she and Sherry ascended the stairs from the third floor to the fourth floor and returned to my grandmother's apartment. There they sat on the plaid mustard-colored couch and watched TV, as if late-night reruns of the Three Stooges could refute my mother's pregnancy and pains and transport them to who they should have been at this time in their life. Nascent teenage girls just beyond the loss of their last baby teeth. Confidants whose essential aims had yet to be developed and so needed to be discussed in that mighty gabbling and giggling best 13-year-old girlfriend will do when awake after midnight. Just as suddenly as each pain before, another crash tried to split my mother in half. She slammed herself into the back of the couch and breathed so hard and fast, snot flew out of her nose. "What's it feel like?" asked Sherry, touching my mother's round belly with both hands. "Goddamn fuck," said my mother, sweating and shaking her head no. "It's like I got lightning inside of me." When the pain dissipated, Sherry got my mother a glass of water from the kitchen. Then there was the sound of keys opening the door, a click and clack, and then two clacks more. Locks were being unlocked. Someone was about to be home. "Ma!" my mother shouted as if she had fallen down a dark hole and feared she would never be found. "Mama!" But it wasn't my grandma. The door opened and my Aunt Rhonda walked in holding Eric in her arms, his legs dangling around her waist as he slept with his head burrowed in the crook of her neck. Eric was two, and he was afflicted with a particular idiosyncrasy that made him somewhat of a spectacle. He was born with Sjogren's syndrome, so he could howl and shout, and Eric could screech and scream until every vein in his head seemed as if it might explode. But he couldn't cry. Never. Not once had there ever been, nor would there ever be, a tear in or fallen from his eyes. "Sorry we so late," my Aunt Rhonda said, taking her keys out of the door, so not yet looking at my mother. "The first movie was sold out, so we had to see the other one." My Aunt Rhonda was 17. She was 5'3" tall, 110 peanut butter brown pounds of a young woman, and the extreme of the lesson my mother was learning. That is, she only knew of loving herself through seeking, finding, and being hurt by men who did not love themselves nor comprehend the value of being someone cherished. She said hello to Sherry. Then she looked at my mother, and her eyes got stuck. "Jelly, what's wrong?" she asked, calling my mother by the nickname she had given her when she was a little girl. "She just got gas," said Sherry. "I made her drink some ginger ale. She'll be all right soon." "See," my Aunt Rhonda scolded, "I told you to stop fucking with all that junk food." Through the open door, my Uncle Roosevelt strode into the apartment, dragging my Aunt Rhonda's eldest son, my cousin, wary-eyed, half-asleep, 4-year-old Donnell by the hand behind him. "Damn, Jelly," Roosevelt said. "Why you look so crazy?" My Uncle Roosevelt was an amber-skinned, narrow-eyed, gangly 9-year-old who already owned the kingly disposition only the world's most blessed men approach possessing. His grace was astounding. No season, situation, no rage, pain, or suffering touched him. He let go of Donnell's hand, crossed in front of my Aunt Rhonda, and came to the couch. "How's the baby?" he asked. "Where's Ma?" my mother said. "She's coming," my Aunt Rhonda answered. "She got stuck talking to Mr. Goins outside." "He loves her," added my Uncle Roosevelt, stating what everyone knew to be the truth. He leaned over my mother and put his ear against her belly. Suddenly my mother winced and moaned and was racked with a wave of pain that made her nostrils flare, lips quiver, and her body shudder as if her ribs were pounding her organs to pieces. My Aunt Rhonda ran to her, seamlessly handing Eric to my Uncle Roosevelt, who cocked his hip, set Eric upon it, and tucked the boy's head beneath his chin without waking him. "Jelly," said Rhonda, wiping the sweat from my mother's forehead with her hand. "Jelly, did your water break?" "I don't know," my mother moaned. "It just hurts." When the contraction ended, my Aunt Rhonda told Sherry to call an ambulance. "No," said my mother. "What you mean, no?" my Aunt Rhonda asked. She stood tall, planted her hands on her hips, and looked down at my mother. "We got to get you to a hospital. James is going to call," said my mother. My Aunt Rhonda sucked her teeth and rolled her eyes as if making a red circle around an incorrect answer in the air. "Jelly, you're about to burst," she scolded. "We don't got time for James." "I got time," said my mother. My father was not the type of man who gave a damn or sacrificed in the name of what was necessary, just, and good. My mother was impulsive and headstrong. We were going to be a family is all she believed. That's it. That seventh grade cusp of pubescent confusion, that dream, it trumped all truth. That conviction was her head and heart and the construction of her vital organs. James would come around. He would realize it was only a pen and she didn't mean to stab him. It was only a matter of time, she thought. They would raise me together. She paid no mind to my Aunt Rhonda's history, the other young histories pushing strollers in the neighborhood, nor would anyone warn her. James Llewellyn Arthur loved her infinity. That's what he told her just before the first times, but never after. Just before she gave him her virginity, just before the first time she gave him head, just before she let him go down on her, bury his lips, lick, lap, and spread the one part of her body she had never studied in the mirror, nor had the courage to touch herself. My grandma came into the apartment. What, are you all crazy or something? She scolded. Why is this door open? Ma, my mother whimpered. My grandma didn't speak. She didn't blink or breathe. A passionately constructed woman of only 30, she swiftly studied the scene. She looked at my mother. She looked at Sherry. She looked at Rhonda. All of my grandma's features possessed the depth and delicacy that made her and everything within 10 feet of her beautiful. Her body and being were balanced. Her arms were long and muscular, as were her legs, fingers, neck, earlobes, and the length of time her laughter lasted. When was the last one? She asked. Just before, maybe not even 2 minutes, said my Aunt Rhonda. She slammed her eyes on Sherry. What'd I tell you? Shit, what the fuck I say? Sherry sprinted into the kitchen where our phone sat on the counter, and my grandma and my Aunt Rhonda led my mother into the bathroom, because the couch was my grandma's first and only couch, and even though she bought it used, she refused for it to be ruined or even slightly stained by anyone or anything, even birth, no matter how divine an occasion it was. Mind your nephews, my grandma told Roosevelt. I got them, he said. He took Donnell's hand, led him and his wide eyes to sit on the couch, and then sat beside him with Eric, still sleeping, balanced against him. In the kitchen, Sherry turned the rotary dial, held the phone to her ear, and listened. Nothing. She tapped the switch hooks, hoping that there was some kind of short, or that one of the buttons was stuck. Still, nothing. She slammed the phone into the cradle, then picked it up and held it to her ear again. Nothing. She slammed the headset down. It's dead, she cried out. There ain't even a dial tone. My grandma closed her eyes and cursed everything under her breath. Queens in the state of New York, the phone company and Everpark, life, herself, America. The phone could have been dead for one of any number of reasons. The phone bill hadn't been paid. The phone company didn't do the proper upkeep. Someone in our building cut a wire thinking splicing it would give them phone service. Go downstairs, shouted my grandma. Don't act like you ain't got no sense, Sherry. Use your phone, and if that one don't work, go use a payphone. Shit, Sherry, don't just give up. Sherry bolted out of our apartment like my grandma's voice was fire. The drum of Sherry's heavy feet could be heard thumping down the stairs until she reached the third floor's door, which squealed when it opened, then boomed when it closed. In the bathroom, my grandma and my Aunt Rhonda helped my mother take off her clothes. My shirt, too? Asked my mother. Shirt, too, ordered my grandma, unless you got the money to pay for a new one if it gets bloody. So off came my mother's shirt. And for a moment, my grandma, my aunt, and my mother just stood there. Three proximate shades of black women. Autumnal hues in a small, plain bathroom with white walls, a white porcelain sink, a white bathtub, and a white toilet with a broken black plastic seat. My grandma and my Aunt Rhonda looked at my mother, who, looking in the bathroom mirror, looked at herself as well. In addition to the disposition and body type of my grandmother, my mother was the color of an old penny at the bottom of a wishing well. Equally, she reflected and absorbed sunshine, street lights, and the hopes of those who wished upon her, then cast her off. Her eyes and lips, her nose, shoulders, and breasts, even her thighs and hips were shaped like new leaves. Full, yet still timid, still approaching their eventual lustrous peak. My grandma snatched the red bath towel from the back of the bathroom door and put it on the floor. Here, she decided, lay down on this, and Rhonda, get behind and hold her. That baby's coming. I can feel it. We ain't got much time. My mother laid down. The bathroom was so small her head crossed the threshold of its doorway. Behind my mother, on her knees, wrapping her arms around her and wedging her thighs against my mother's back, my Aunt Rhonda kneeled on the coarse gray carpet of the living room. My grandma stepped into the bathtub. She hiked her skirt up over her knees, squatted, and put my mother's ankles on her shoulders. Lord have mercy, she said. Lord have some fucking mercy on me. My mother sweated, shivered, and writhed from the pain and the fright. Another contraction came and went. Then she cursed and screamed and told my grandma she didn't want to live no more. Jelly, shut your mouth, demanded my grandma. Stop thinking about yourself. You're about to be a mother. On the couch, Donnell asked question after question, and Eric awoke and hollered for my Aunt Rhonda. He reached for her. He fought to get out of my Uncle Roosevelt's arms. My uncle tried to keep them calm. He hushed my cousins, and he softly sang verses of spontaneously composed lullabies. He tried to remind them about the movie they just saw, how E.T. had a magic finger and loved Reese's Pieces candy. My mother quaked with another contraction, and she moaned and rolled her head from side to side as if her neck and spine were suddenly severed. Then she stopped and looked down at the round mound of her belly, her eyes so wide it seemed she was surprised by the sight. She put her hands on it, and with her fingers spread as wide as they could stretch, my mother began to weep. But it was not weeping caused by physical pain or by ignorance, or even a weeping caused by fear. My mother wept because although she was still a child, she had enough sense to understand that she was not prepared to shape my life. She couldn't multiply or divide. She didn't know north, south, east, or west. She couldn't tell time on a regular clock. This is not to say she was dumb. In fact, my mother was brilliant. So smart she could remember all of the words in a song after hearing it just once. What my mother was then was the product of failed, of low expectations. She had been failed, so she had failed. And yet social promotion. She had just completed the seventh grade. But when she felt weak, when she felt hopeless and useless and begged my grandma to make the pain stop, to let her quit, my grandma said no. My mother couldn't stop, not even if great God Almighty himself said she could quit. And so because my grandma was not the type of woman anyone could disregard, my mother pushed with her life. She clenched the air in her fists. She gritted her teeth. She closed her eyes so tightly she saw everything she'd ever wished to see, every mountain and ocean, every sandy beach, tropical waterfall, elephants and lions and giraffes. She saw Jesus. She shook President Reagan's hand. She saw the Statue of Liberty, herself with a car, a fur coat. She saw herself as a movie star. Her toes curled, her calves cramped. Her heart became a volcano bursting blood. She saw her dreams. She felt their temperature. She smelled them. My grandma saw my head. She took it in her hands and pulled gently, but then holding one hand up as if halting a train, she shouted, "Stop!" Every muscle in my mother's body went limp. My umbilical cord was wrapped twice around my neck. My mother's pushing combined with my twisting and turning was killing me. I was being lynched, and I was hanging myself. My face was the color of an electric blue bruise. One more push or pull, one more twist, and I was dead. My mother begged to understand what was happening. "Mama," she said, propping herself on her elbows. "Mama, please." "What's wrong?" asked Rhonda. "Ma, what is it?" My grandma breathed deep. "Shh, both of you. Let me think." Outside of the bathroom, Eric stopped hollering. Donnell stopped asking questions. And my Uncle Roosevelt stopped hushing and singing lullabies. All of Ever Park, all of Queens, went silent. Then in through the door burst Sherry. "They coming," she shouted. "An ambulance is on the way." My Aunt Rhonda looked over her shoulder at Sherry, her eyes demanding silence. Sherry stopped in the middle of the living room. "What's going on?" she said, her voice a fraction of its preceding size. In the bathroom, my grandma looked up at the ceiling. "God," she whispered, "Jesus, somebody please help me save this child." My grandma took one deep breath, closed her eyes, and made the same prayer silently. Then she opened her eyes, gently held my head, and slowly drew my shoulders free. She paused to think. What next? What could she possibly do? The umbilical cord was taut. She cupped her hand beneath me, breathed, then cautiously guiding me in an unhurried somersault. My grandma turned me upside down, freed my legs, and unwound the umbilical cord from my neck. My grandma saved me from that which fed and kept me for the first 9 months of my life. She cleared my nostrils and mouth with her pinky. Then she wiped the blood from me with the palm of her hand. Roosevelt, she called out, get me a knife, a sharp one, one of the ones with the wooden handles. But it wasn't my uncle who brought my grandma the knife. It was my cousin, Donnell. Like a four-year-old miniature Mercury, he burst into the bathroom and held the knife out to her. Then he stood on his tiptoes and looked at the new life my grandma cradled to her chest. This your baby cousin, she said. She pushed me into his arms. Now hold love strong. Donnell held me against his chest like a ball of loose yarn, and my grandma cut my umbilical cord and left me the ugliest outy belly button the world has ever seen. She washed me in the sink and handed me to my mother. And as my mother held me on the floor in the bathroom, as she wept and dealt with the awe of my making, Rhonda asked what my name should be, because my mother had not yet been able to settle on one. Abraham, my grandma announced. Like the president? Rhonda asked. No, said my grandma. Like the old man in the Bible that God said was going to be the father of a great people as numerous as the stars.